The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Liam Mitchell is the author of the book Ludopolitics, Video Games Against Control, which came out from Zero Books in December. And he's a guest this week as we discuss Heidegger, Universal Reason, and video games such as Skyrim, Zelda, and The Duck Game. It's Thursday, January 16th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's Zero Books podcast is free for everyone. Next week's podcast on nihilism will be available in its entirety through Patreon. Patreon subscribers get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. If you're listening for free, you'll be able to access one or the other podcast each week, and this week you're getting Zero Squared. The music you're listening to right now is the main menu music from the game Fortnite. And in just a moment, you'll be listening to Liam Mitchell and I discuss the YouTube video that asked, "Is Fortnite heroin?"
I enjoy making these. It's a chance for me to kind of dip my own toe into critical theory or philosophy, but it's also kind of a grueling schedule. I have to think deeply every week.
Yeah, it's kind of like teaching at a university, except people are constantly criticizing you and like expressing it in the comments and in the likes and dislikes. That would be like way more exhausting than just getting course evaluations at the end of a semester. No thanks.
Everyone used to the YouTube comments. The worst ones are actually now the ones that are rather rigorous and sometimes correct. Those are the ones I really hate. Okay, so what I want to do is just I'm already recording. And what I want to do is just start by asking you to tell the listeners who you are and what Ludopolitics is about.
I'm Liam Mitchell. I'm an associate professor at Trent University in the Cultural Studies and Media Studies programs. And I teach classes about video games and social media and, you know, media theory, media history, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I try to get away from that as much as possible and spend my time playing video games when I'm not teaching or hanging out with my family, because I've been doing it for years, right? My early work was sort of about social media, Facebook, Reddit, 4chan, things like that. It was taking a sort of philosophical and political look at how something like Facebook operates. So not, you know, concerns with privacy or with ideology or with, you know, Zuckerberg's pursuit of profit, but taking seriously the notion that something like Facebook can modify the terms of our engagement with reality, right? That they can change how we understand the world, or if it's not forceful and causal like that, that it can symptomatize how our understanding of the world is starting to shift, right? So the fact that something like Facebook can come into existence tells us something about what we take the world to be, about what's included in the world and what's excluded from it. And so that goes along with, you know, some other criticisms of stuff like social media, like Eli Pariser's filter bubble, right? The notion that on Facebook, there are only certain things that cross your desk and other things you never, ever hear about, likewise on Google. Anyway, so I was doing that kind of work and just getting bummed out by it. And so I wanted to keep talking about, you know, this philosophical politics, this cultural politics, but shift it to a venue that I thought was ultimately a lot more interesting, where I didn't have to just spend my time talking about what was bad or wrong or problematic, but where I could talk about some interesting aesthetic and political possibilities. And so hence the turn to video games, right? I think that there's a lot of really interesting stuff, obviously, that different art forms can do. And I think that there's a connection between, you know, like the art form of the day, that is to say the game, and then like general assumptions about how society functions, about how the world operates, assumptions about digitality, right? About things being on or off, one or zero. And so the book Ludopolitics is less this, you know, critique of bad video games, bad political messages in video games, how something like The Division is racist or Candy Crush just models capitalism. I really like Alfie Brown's book, don't get me wrong, but it's not doing that kind of a critique. What it's trying to do instead is to say, okay, video games in general offer us this unfettered power fantasy where we can map and master worlds, where we can explore and ultimately exhaust them. And they promise us the ability to extend that beyond. But I think what's instead interesting is all the games and gameplay practices that players engage in that do something different, right? That break with that tendency, that let you go in a completely different direction. So I think it's, you know, often the case that the master's tools can dismantle the master's house. And this is one example of how that works. So the book does like these really extended deep dives into a few different games and a few different gameplay practices, things like, you know, video games like Spec Ops and Undertale and Bastion, and gameplay practices like speed running and myth making and data mining.
I was curious about the Heideggerian turn in your book. As a dirty Marxist, I consider that a deviation, but
yes.
Nonetheless, I was interested in it because I read your book and because I had to produce this video about it. I spent some time with Heidegger, and he's a fascinating philosopher. I think people tend to think he's more difficult than maybe he is. He seems to me like a romantic. Ultimately, would you agree with that?
Yeah, sure. There's certainly, I think like there's, you know, utility in Heidegger, and then there's some tremendously problematic stuff. And I think when he gets really Volkish and nostalgic, then yeah, for sure, he harkens back to a problematic romanticism and sometimes, you know, can be interpreted to say that, you know, there is an authentic and an inauthentic. There's a pre-technological and a contemporary technological, and we need to get back to the authentic or get back to what was. And I think that's, generally speaking, like that kind of a reading is focusing on like the least interesting parts of what he does, or is like a straightforward misreading, right? So like with regard to technology, for instance, he's got, I think in the video that you produced, you quoted from a public address he gave in 1955 about Kreutzer. And around the same time in like the late 40s to the early 50s, Heidegger was talking a lot about technology. So that's the time in which he was writing The Age of the World Picture and The Question Concerning Technology. And that latter essay is the jumping off point for me in most of my work. And I'm not going to get into the whole argument there, but basically the notion that he wants to get away from technology, to go back to something that was, to just step away from it for a bit so that we might reengage with it productively, I think he doesn't suffer from that illusion, right? He doesn't think that there's a return to a past that once was. He thinks that past probably never was. And the only way of dealing with modern technology is just kind of sticking in it and figuring out what we can do, that we don't ultimately have any control over how the world is revealed to us, which is how he understands technology. It's a mode of revealing. I think you're totally right. He's a romantic, yeah. And I mean, my God, the guy was a Nazi who ultimately got on board with Hitler's project. So don't get me wrong. Like, he's tremendously politically problematic, and I stand by that. But I think there's some utility, especially in the critique of the philosophy of technology stuff. And I think you can connect that in with some earlier work, too. The being in time is the stuff that's really tricky to get your head around, right?
Well, look, here's how I think about engaging with someone like Heidegger. I consider, or like engaging with someone like Nietzsche, I think of it the same way. These are one-sided philosophers, but they are nonetheless immensely important. If you can critique Heidegger, you're going to be far better off than if you can't. My understanding of that essay or that lecture he gave was not so much that he was calling for a return to the past or some tradition that used to exist and didn't exist in the present, but that he was actually resisting the kind of ideology that he thought was dominating modernity. And it was mostly the way in which we conceived of our relationship to the world, which led us to a kind of thinking, which was, he called it the calculative thinking. And he was in favor of a meditative thinking, which had to do, admittedly, this is all, you know, you're a scholar on Heidegger and I'm someone who's run to pick up some Heidegger and put something together. But nonetheless, this is what my understanding of it is. You know, he has this kind of an anti-metaphysical philosophy, turning against Plato and Descartes. He wants to claim that the way that we understand the world and our relationship to what really is in the world has to do with our being in the world rather than our standing apart from it, maybe through a moment of doubt, and coming up with true conceptions. What he's hoping to achieve is an approach to the world which will lead to kind of excellence, kind of authenticity, something rather heroic, which is an acceptance of the nothingness of our own existence, the acceptance of finitude and the embrace of the reality of death. And through that, then the development of a project that will arrive and arise out of your engagement that's already been set up before you were even born. The way that you were thrown into the world kind of sets up the terms in which you will engage with it. So you're being in the world. This would lead to, I think, kind of the mentality of the artisan, the person who thinks of their life in terms of developing a skill, a practice, a project, but not a critique and not necessarily a conceptual understanding. Is that all fair?
Not all. Largely, yeah, sure. And I think there's some really important stuff to grab onto there. I really want to talk especially about finitude and thrownness and like the third element that goes along with that, not just the past and the present, but also the current situatedness with others, right? Being with others in the world is another one of these basic existential states that you just can't get outside of. And that really radically influences how you conduct yourself with others. And I think that's all fundamentally tied up with control and power fantasies and video games, right? Digital systems. So I want to come back to that. But I think that the part about the artisan is, yeah, sure, one way that you can end up going. And it's certainly something that Heidegger valorized here and there when he talks about, you know, peasants and the people and you know, the origin of the work of art and all that stuff. So he does open that up as a possibility. And I think that's one of the places where you can hang your hat and say what Heidegger is about is authenticity and presence and meditative thinking and so on. So my caution here is this. He's not wanting to achieve something like a 24/7 state of meditative thinking. He doesn't think that. For instance, in Being in Time, he talks about fallenness, right? About how we're inauthentic because we've fallen away from something. And the implication seems to be that we need to get back to it and that it's a, you know, a prelapsarian problem. You know, we want to move back to where we had fallen from. And I think that's not it, right? He says that, yeah, there's a state of authenticity. There's a kind of meditative being in the world where you, that subject-object division starts to fall away. But generally speaking, we kind of need to be inauthentic. We need to be, you know, calculative thinkers. We need to be more or less rational in order to just get shit done. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But what's definitely wrong is doing nothing but that, right? And that's where he seems to think that there's, where he definitely thinks that there's a problem heralded and intensified by modern technology, that it displaces any other way of being in the world than one which takes things as means to ends, just endless means to ends. And this is where Heidegger's philosophical criticism of technology links in really nicely with a criticism of, you know, capitalism just constantly eating the world, just bringing more and more stuff into it in an endless kind of devouring. It's why, who's the philosopher now? Who wrote One Dimensional Man? Marcuse. Marcuse in the 1930s was trying to marry Heidegger and Marx, right? He has a book on the subject. Eventually he fell away from it and said, no, this guy's a Nazi. I'm not trucking with this. And he mounted an explicit critique. But there have been people out there, Ian Angus in Vancouver is another one, who have tried to put together like this economic critique and the philosophical critique that Heidegger offers.
This morning when I first got up, because of the lifestyle I live, one of the first things I do is flip open my laptop at the kitchen table and start brewing coffee. And, it's already on YouTube and it's already recommending that I watch the latest Zizek lecture interview thing that was at the New York Public Library. And it's like on December 3rd. This just happened, right? And so I'm like, oh, new Zizek. What's new about this is that they've got the star of a documentary film called Man on a Wire, which is a documentary film about a man who threw a tightrope between the two towers, twin towers, you know, but this is before 9/11, obviously, and walked from one tower to the other and filmed it. And, you know, he did this illegally, and there's a whole documentary film about that. And the man who did that is paired with Slavoj Žižek at the New York Public Library. It seems like television to me, maybe old style TV, like 60s and 70s TV, but nonetheless sort of sensational. But Žižek is interesting. He asks him, when you're on the wire, did you have any impulses? Or, you know, I'm such a neurotic, I would obsess about the possibility not just of falling, but willing myself to fall. The guy answers and he says, no, I didn't worry. I had no fear of falling because I was walking on this wire. Falling was not even a thought, and flying away from the wire, that's something someone else might do. But I was simply walking on this wire. I thought about him saying this while you were talking about Heidegger's insistence that we have to be calculative some of the time. And I would just object and say, this man on the wire is probably perfectly Heideggerian because he is so skilled and so good at walking that tightrope because he's a circus performer. He's done it for years and years and years. He no longer has to calculate. He no longer has this relationship where what he's doing is conceptual. And that means that when he's on that wire, he isn't pondering all the possibilities, right? He isn't stepping apart from his own activity to consider it. He is fully engaged in a process with the world rather than standing apart from it, which is why he got from one tower to another and did this miraculous thing. So if there's some real strength to Heidegger, it's that he points out that phenomena, that phenomena of being truly practiced, truly knowledgeable, and truly engaged. You can see, it's something that happens even with so-called intellectual activities. Like if you're a writer, or I guess if you're a philosopher, I'm not sure, but if you're a writer or a poet, or musician, so it's maybe more artistic. There are moments where you stop thinking about, you're not thinking about commas. You're not even thinking about what the right word would be. You are simply engaging with your own line of thought, putting it onto the page. It's as if it comes up from the page. I would think that would be what Heidegger is reaching for the most.
Okay, so I want to point out some useful stuff in there, and then like some problematic tendencies and ways to get around them. So, and the problematic tendencies basically have to do with the division between the personal and the political, and that's, you know, or the philosophical and the political. And I think that's somewhere where this conversation could go. But yeah, the utility there is real, right? Like, the example of the tightrope walker is a really nice one. Yeah, that person can't be thinking about putting one foot in front of another and where it goes, or you will fall. It's the same as, you know, Nietzsche talking about dancing. You can't think about dancing. As soon as that happens, you step on your own feet. So you have to get out of your head. It's only because we forget that we are capable of action at all, right? And the same thing happens with something like yoga, any of these states in which you have a division between subject and object that gets collapsed, a division between the ego and the world that gets collapsed, then you have this possibility for what, you know, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi would call flow, right? And that's where it would be used in video games. You want to get this flow state for players in which they're not too frustrated and not too bored, in which they're just consistently engaged. And there's a real dark side to that, right? The kind of flow state that comes into playing something like Fortnite forever, or that, you know, where you're gambling your life away in front of video lottery machines, something like that. Natasha Dow-Shule has an incredible book about this. So anyway, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. I think there's some real individual utility in that. The challenge to me seems Okay, cool. What do you do with that beyond, you know, kind of personal betterment? You know, read Heidegger and understand that these are some limitations to your existence in the world, and you can transcend those limitations by doing some things and by getting more present. It's like telling people to be more mindful. It's really nice. And if everyone did it, I'm sure the world would be a better place. But how do you instrumentalize that? And the caution is that, you know, well, what Heidegger wanted to do was get a really strong leader in place and then whip the Volk into shape such that they would unify, right? And that kind of a nationalist project that comes out of this philosophical tendency or this personal preference is terrifying. So I think we've got to move from that sort of a philosophy or personal politics into a broader politics some other way, right?
Why did Heidegger think that was necessary?
Oh, God, man. You'd have to go read the Black Notebooks.
yeah.
You know, like, I spent some time much earlier, you know, like 10 years ago or whatever, when I was first doing my doctoral work, thinking about Heidegger's Nazism and reading some smart people on it, and ultimately decided, look, I don't need to deal with this in order to get out of the guy what I need to get out of the guy, which is the critique of technology and the basic existential analysis.
Well, I guess my question is, put it this way, why did Heidegger think that in order for people to develop their own projects as beings thrown in the world? And why was it necessary to have a master, to have a strong leader, in order to be able to face your finitude and commit to taking the risk of being excellent? Because it's easy enough to conform with what is, to find yourself thrown into the world and simply get along, to be part of a herd, maybe to be Nietzschean about it, but, you know, just to conform. And he's not asking for that. That's not what his philosophy is about. His philosophy is about recognizing your relationship to the world and sacrificing yourself to it in a way that will allow you to develop true, authentic excellence or authentic engagement. But why was it necessary for there to be a leader for that to happen?
When we became self-aware, we became aware of the end of self, of our animal insignificance and finitude. And this led to a crippling anxiety that we had to counter by creating culture, that is, activities and beliefs that would give us the illusion that we are persons of value in an enduring world of meaning. This byproduct of self-awareness came to assume a central role in human behavior, rendering older functions like our ape hierarchies, our morality, sexuality, and intelligence subordinate to it. That is, making them bound by culture, which through self-esteem would work constantly to push our fears into the deep recesses of the unconscious. But without a culture providing a great sense of cosmic significance, humans could not successfully quell their death anxiety and achieve satisfactory self-esteem. The shift toward surplus and materialism in civilization meant that our previous sense of cosmic significance and literal immortality was undermined. Whereas primitive religions are deemed to have provided great cosmic significance to everyone in the tribe, it subsequently came to be concentrated in elite figures like pharaohs and kings, with delayed and conditional otherworldly rewards for the rest of the population. This left the world in a chronic state of deficient self-esteem, with a predictable increased search, invention, and emphasis on less fulfilling, more earthly sources of personal significance and symbolic immortality or legacy. This includes things like national identity, money, progress, jobs, hobbies, and inflation of celebrity figures, as well as of day-to-day triviality. A central property of these human sources of self-esteem is that they constitute narrow-focused strategies, what Ernest Becker called fetishes. Since we are insignificant in the big scheme of things, we focus on a small or narrow aspect of real or invented reality where we can more easily gain a sense of personal significance. This, unfortunately, made us oblivious and intolerant of other realities.
So I think the short answer is that there's no necessity there, and that there's a pretty sharp division between the man's politics and his philosophy, that his politics took him down a really dark path. But that's a really tricky argument to make. There's other people, you know, like Adorno, who would say that, no, the fascism is inherent in the politics way before Being in Time, and certainly in Being in Time, this is where it takes you. Someone like Derrida wouldn't agree with that and would try to, you know, take other things out of Heidegger and redeploy what it is that he's doing. And so that's the way that I'm trying to take him to. So I think that's the short answer. And I think the long answer gets into the nitty gritty of the philosophy, which is just not that interesting, except for foreign specialists who learn German in order to read Heidegger. So one other thing I want to pick up on just really quick in what you said there was that you described it as a needing to sacrifice yourself to the world. And I think that's like almost right. I think what he's talking about is something like a commitment to the world, or an acceptance of your being in the world, an acceptance of your finitude. So the emblematic instance of that is, you know, being willing to accept the fact that you're going to die. But the other one that's super interesting and political is the Mitsein, the being with others, right? Accepting the fact that your actions ultimately are contingent on the actions of others, that you don't totally have control, that you're acting into a world where other people are also acting, and that there is the possibility of the new. And so this is how someone like Hannah Arendt will take up Heidegger instead, right? She'll focus on the birth of the new into the world through this political work with others. That's what she wants to get out of it. So I think like that's the most interesting way to take him, right? To focus on the commitment to the world, or in your terms, the sacrifice to the world, recognizing that you don't get to totally control it at the end of the day. There's certain things that you can do, but it's not everything. And what we're promised through technology, through capitalism, through economics is the ability to do everything, right? One of the examples that I point to in Ludopolitics is just the ludicrous notion that we will one day be able to program matter itself just as we program computers, right? That electrons and all of that is just basically ones and zeros at the end of the day. What if we just had the right nanomachines? Or it's the idiot fantasy of the singularity, right? That we'll finally have total control by virtue of AI. We won't, but that's the power fantasy. That's the dream that's held out there. And that's something that I think like kind of a gentler philosophy, for lack of a better word, or a philosophy that's accepting of the world can help with. But you don't have to do that, right? You don't have to read Heidegger in order to get there. There's lots of different ways to get to that different comprehension of the world, that different basic pre-understanding of it.
Let's talk about video games a little bit. Tell me how you think video games reinforce a kind of instrumental thinking or rationalized thinking.
Sure. It basically has to do with the pleasures that games give you, right? A lot of people have observed this. The satisfaction that you get from a game isn't about winning so much as it is about achieving a relationship to the game's system that's more or less intuitive. When you kind of, you know, sink into that flow state that I was talking about earlier, or when you just really fully understand how the game functions such that you can move through it more or less smoothly. And that's going to be the case whether you're talking about a fast response game where Twitch reactions are important, or something slow and methodical and strategic. I'm playing a lot of Into the Breach right now, which is very much that, right? You're just thinking constantly in the terms of the game, and the more time that you spend with it, the better you get at mastering that system. So nothing wrong with that, right? Like, I'm not at all saying that first-person shooters should be banned or whatever. None of stuff. I think it's just fine to have those kinds of pleasures. But I think that you can see an extension of that basic logic of mapping and mastering a world, figuring it out in systematic terms, which the game more or less offers you, and then transposing that to other realities, to the economy in terms of high frequency trading and the way that the stock market functions, or to politics in terms of it operating in first past the post, whatever. There's all these different ways in which the world has become a game-like world. Mackenzie Work makes this argument really forcefully in Gamer Theory, but lots of other people do too. And so that's not like a deliberate move of the logic from the video game onto something else, so much as it is the video game demonstrating a logic that already inheres elsewhere, the logic according to which we can understand the world systematically in terms of something where there is a truth or a falsehood, a one or a zero. And then we can manipulate it and use it to a particular set of means. And I'm speaking very generally and abstractly here, because I think you can take this technological logic and transpose it onto a bunch of different systems and see how it operates. So I think, like, that's the concern that I have with games, is that they operate as that kind of systematic power fantasy. It's not like the power fantasy of stomping on a dude's face, or like looking at a poorly clad woman who's just there docile. It's not that, though it is that too. It's the deeper power fantasy of having a system that you can control. I can keep going, but you just cut me off and asked me a different question.
Okay, I will. Back in the 90s, I read the already dated book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. In that book, he describes how someone who's really good at motorcycle maintenance doesn't need a manual, and will be able to do a motorcycle repair, sometimes in a preventative way, sometimes in creative ways, that the person with the most detailed manual would never be able to achieve. That can't be simply conceived of or intellectualized and recreated on a page. So, like, the same thing's true of video games. I can read the manual. I can look at my older son was pretty good at Super Smash Brothers Melee, and he developed a skill at that by playing it probably too much. It was the first video game where he could beat me. See, and I'm an 80s kid. I'm pretty good at video games. I'm okay, you know, anyway. And you know, when he was a young kid, I sometimes I'd let him win, but, you know, I could always beat him. In this game, I could never beat him. I got, like, instructional videos and learning the little clicks and all, and I would get a technique and barely be able to do it, and then go in and just get trashed again. It didn't matter how much I tried to learn it. In fact, the novel I mentioned in this video was sort of the result of being humiliated in Super Smash Brothers Melee. I wrote a fantasy novel in which the middle-aged dad became the Super Smash Brothers champion of the world. How? With the help of the truly intelligent, self-conscious AI in the book. Definitely a rejection of my finitude. But in any case, the question I'm trying to get to asking you is, where is this division between the calculative and the meditative? It seems as though one, you know, that's just something simple like practice makes perfect. It seems like the one leads to the other. You have to start with the calculative. And that since they're connected, it seems like there's something we're leaving out when we consider the world between the calculative and the meditative, or the instrumental and the meaningful. There's something else.
Yeah, I think that kind of a stark division between those two modalities of being in the world would probably be too simple and isn't going to neatly map onto all the examples that you have in front of you. And it's not really one that I make a lot of reference to in Ludopolitics either. You know, like I said, the stuff that I take from Heidegger is more just the philosophy of technology bit, which has to do with calculation, but not so much in terms of like a mode of existence in the world. Like, it's either this or it's that. So I think, yeah, you're pointing to like a really nice example of a moving back and forth between those two different states, if you want to call them that. So it's not such an easy division. Yeah, there's that. The other thing that I think you get out of playing Smash or, you know, maintaining motorcycles or cooking for a very long time is going to be the understanding that you can have like a literal algorithm, right? Like a recipe is an algorithm. Take these parts, do this, then do that, out will come product X. Same thing with Smash. If you just learn to press the buttons in these waves, then you can wave dash and then you can be better than your opponents, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, that's not true, right? So that's the fantasy, is that if you have the algorithm exposed, if you have like either a technical understanding of it or an intuitive understanding of it, then you're going to be finally really good at something. And the thing is, anyone who gets really, really good at that stuff knows that's not true, right? So that's one of the major claims that I'm trying to make in the book, is that, you know, video game players, like hackers, like people who actually do politics, like anyone out in the world who's pursued something for a long time, they know that nothing is perfect. They know that nothing is closed, that no system is totally out there in front of you, able to be mastered. There's always glitches and bugs and shit that you can take advantage of, and stuff that's just unexpected, right? Like, even the 0-1 of the computer isn't actually a 0-1, right? It's 0 volts, or it's 5 volts, or it's something in between, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen, even at the level of hardware. So I think like a really sophisticated, thorough understanding of anything, including a video game, gets you to that understanding of the finitude, not just of people, but also of systems, right? Things are complex, they break down, they're interdependent. No one Nintendo is the same as another Nintendo, right? It's supposed to be these totally fungible products, but they're not. So they get away from that fantasy of fungibility, among many other things.
So I at this point want to go like really stupid. So what are some of your favorite video games right now?
Yeah, man, that's the conversation I mostly want to have. So like I said, I picked up Into the Breach for the Nintendo Switch. It came out earlier this year and everyone's been raving about it. It's this game from Subset. They put out Faster Than Light earlier, and it's basically like a little chessboard in which you control three gigantic mechs, you know, like building size monstrosities that are fighting space monsters. And it's wonderful because it puts the space monsters out there and then it tells you exactly what they are going to do. So you know perfectly well what will happen next turn. You have all the information in front of you. And then you have to figure out what's your strategy for minimizing damage and maximizing like your basically your score at the end of the game. It's just so deeply satisfying. I'm finally progressing into hard mode now and really digging it. I like that, right? And that kind of a game to me isn't like philosophically interesting. It doesn't do much, but I just really enjoy playing it. I poured a ton of time into Breath of the Wild, the new Zelda game, earlier this year. But the games that I find, you know, the
what
most.
Did you like? What do you think of that? Because that's one I've played, the Breath of the Wild. Because my 16-year-old son, who was 15 at the time, you know, insisted that we have to get it for the Wii U that we have. And I find that world to be too big. Like I get bored in that world. There's the potential to run around and do nothing for an hour, is too present. So I kind of abandon that. I don't like Skyrim very much either, because it's dark and hard to see things and kind of dreary.
And Skyrim is like jam packed. Like you throw a rock quite literally and you will hit a new quest or something to do, right? Whereas Breath of the Wild, yeah, it's pretty spread out and it's possible to wander around and do nothing, which was the thing about it that I really loved. Like I liked wandering and not being sure what was going to happen. And then there comes a point even in that game where you understand the game full well, right? And you're like, okay, there's stuff to do everywhere, but it's just iterations of the same. It's more Bokoblin camps. There's going to be another shrine. It's going to have another puzzle. The puzzle might have an interesting twist, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I dug it. I don't have that much to say about it. Like the stuff that I have to say is more about games where there's an interesting bridge between the game's mechanics and then the story that it's telling. And frankly, like it's an enormous problem with my mode of analysis that I only really know how to talk about games where there are interesting narratives as well as mechanics that support them. Like I just don't have the language for describing like I say, puzzle-based games or procedurally generated games or even multiplayer games. Like there's so much out there in the world.
Have you played the Duck Game? Have you played Duck Game?
About it. It looks great. I have not played it.
Oh my God, it's terrible. What about games? What about games like that where they're horrible and you can't stop doing it? What about that? Have you had that experience?
Oh, God. Yeah, of course. I don't
like Flappy Bird.
So Skyrim's a good example of that, right? Like, Skyrim is not, I don't think, a good game. It's one of my favorite games, and then I poured tons of hours into it. It's deeply satisfying. It's really fun to kind of explore and exhaust that world. But there's not that much to say about it. It's not that rewarding as an aesthetic experience. It's just something that you get sucked into and you can't get out of it. But the thing that I found fun about Skyrim was figuring out how ultimately to break it. Like, I played the hell out of that game. And by the end of it, it's got this system wherein you can get rid of all of the points that you've accumulated in a particular skill and kind of transcend, get a legendary skill, I think it's called, if memory serves, and then keep accumulating it again. And that gives you a very small bonus to your overall stats. I found a way to automate that. Just like, you know, stick a screwdriver down on a keyboard, get these particular pieces of equipment, cast this alteration spell, and you can just do that shit again and again and again and become like ridiculously overpowered. And that became kind of fun, right? Just messing around with the system, figuring out what the limitations were, reading a bunch of wikis and people's comments out there, finding out what you can do with the game that the designers did not intend but is there anyway. And I think that's not that uncommon. I think a lot of players, like when they've sunk hundreds of hours into something, figure out those glitches, figure out what they can do, and find interesting ways of trifling with the game, right? Not playing to the game's.
Yeah, that's what happened with Super Smash Bros. Melee. I mean, that game was not meant to be a competitive game, but there were so many variations and glitches sort of in the game that it became a competitive game specifically by people kind of breaking it. Here, let me tell you two of my favorite games, and tell me if you played them and what do you think of them. Portal. In Portal 2, and then the Stanley Parable.
Yeah, sure. I teach the Stanley Parable. I talk about it briefly in the book as well. Yeah, Portal. Okay. Portal is another one of those games where you can break it fairly easily. Like, it's a brilliant, fun, clever puzzle game on its own, and just a genius mechanic that's deeply satisfying to play through once or twice, especially Portal 2 with a friend. Super fun, right? Again, what's most interesting to me about a game like Portal isn't the narrative or the puzzles, and not even the interaction of the two in that case. It's about what the players do with that game, right? The ways in which that game has opened itself up to speedrunning. Because you can do crazy stuff by situating your character in just such a position and, you know, casting your portal, shooting your portal gun in one direction, and then like stepping out of bounds, outside of the world, and just glitching through to the next level or whatever. That stuff's super interesting. There's a community of people out there who do that for Portal, and a huge community of speedrunners who are in the business of sequence breaking and glitching games and completing them as quickly as possible, right? So that's what I would say about Portal. And I talk about a bunch of that stuff with regard to like Super Mario World and whatever in the book.
I played that one too. Yeah, Super Mario World.
Oh, I'm so bad at that. Shockingly bad. I got a Nintendo Classic last year and I think I made it 5 levels in and just kept dying. And my 2-year-old daughter thought it was hilarious. And I set it down, haven't come back.
right.
Stanley Parable's fun. Stanley Parable is specifically about, you know, that kind of fantasy of totality that I'm talking about, right? And it's not like the deepest reflection on it. So for anyone who hasn't played it, it's a game in which you're a character named Stanley. You are in an office building. It's apparently empty. And as soon as the game starts, a narrator starts speaking, right? The narrator says, you know, Stanley left the office, blah, blah, blah. And you walk down. And then the first choice that you encounter is a move between a door on your left and a door on your right. And the narrator intones, Stanley walked through the door on his left. But he says that before you make the choice yourself as a player. So then you as a player either get to go through the left, like the narrator tells you to do, or go through the right. And if you go through the right, the narrator is irritated with you. And then it generates 24 different endings or something like that. Basically offers this commentary on player choice, on player agency, and the fiction of agency. I think as far as it goes, it's a fine game. It absolutely does what it sets out to do. It carries on this legacy of like meta critique of video games that started with BioShock. And that's great. You know, like I think that works as this kind of like Brechtian intervention into the structure of video games and player agency that's super useful. And so I always teach that at the beginning of this game studies course that I offer because it's fun. It's a great teaching tool. And it's also hilarious. Like it's deeply funny.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite games. And I don't know when that game was originally made, like there's been two versions of it.
2013, but there was an earlier version in I think 2007 when it was a Gary's Mod extension. So that's the other thing, it like came out of players modding the god, what is it now, It's not Quake.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
What's the game that it came out of?
Half-Life.
Right?
Yeah. So
you don't get the Stanley Parable without players screwing around with stuff and discovering new ways to do things. So Stephanie Bullock and Patrick Lemieux make this argument in metagaming that games aren't just games. Games are tools for making other things, right? You can always do stuff inside of the game to create something else. So you can enter a particular sequence of just your, like, the buttons on the controller in Super Mario World and program a new game inside of it once you know how the game works. It's really neat.